Hey everyone, we've got a brand new sponsor.
BagsUnlimited.com.
BagsUnlimited.com has a huge catalog of vinyl supplies, from record sleeves to storage boxes to cardboard mailers, record bags, and more. Whether you're just starting your collection or you're already the biggest record shop in the state, you can buy your vinyl supplies direct at BagsUnlimited.com.
And now, on with the show.
Welcome to The Vinyl Guide, the podcast for record collectors and music nerds. Here's your host, the biggest record nerd of them all, Nate Goyer.
Well, hello, everyone. It's Nate. Welcome to episode 444 of The Vinyl Guide. 444, triple fours we got on the board. Holy mackerel. And what better way to celebrate that sort of weird milestone with two guests today involved in perhaps my favorite band of all time, Melvins, longtime creative collaborators, Buzz Osborne and Toshi Kasai. Now, you all know Buzz as a guitarist and co-founder of Melvins, and Toshi is their longtime engineer, producer, and collaborator. So, if Melvins are the Beatles, then Toshi is George Martin. And today we talk to both Buzz and Toshi about their history together, working on Melvins' solo projects, the extremely unique approach of the new Melvins album, Tarantula Heart. We talk about some upcoming recordings, outtakes, vinyl records we can expect to see, and quite a bit more. So enjoy this conversation and grab the new Melvins album, Tarantula Heart, from Ipecac. You can pre-order vinyl, ipecac.com, or Blixt merchandise. Or when you see Buzz on tour with Trevor Dunn, those dates and details and other music records and miscellaneous horseshit over at ipecac.com. And, if you listen in nice and closely to today's interview, you'll be able to hear the squeaking of Toshi's chair. Yep, there it is. Now, quick peoples, before we get into the interview, two quick reminders. There's an extended version of this interview only for show patrons, patreon.com/vinylguide. And that's where supporters get extra material, longer, more detailed interviews. There are also commercial-free episodes and high-resolution audio. So when you become a patron, patreon.com/vinylguide, you get all those extras. And as the second reminder, we have several other recent episodes that Melvins fans and record collectors may enjoy, including episode 435 with Dale Crover of Melvins, episode 438 with Tom Flynn of Boner Records, episode 425 with Matt Cameron of Pearl Jam and Soundgarden, professing his love and homage to Melvins, episode 398 with Ray and Blackie from Hard-Ons, episode 416 with Billy Stevenson of Descendants All and Black Flag, and again, tons of other episodes, over 400 available to enjoy anytime. Just follow The Vinyl Guide in your podcast app, and you could listen to each one. All right, I think I bored you enough. Let's get into our conversation with Mr. Buzz Osborne and Toshi Kasai on Recording Melvins. Guys, Buzz, Toshi, thank you for making the time. You guys have been working together for years. It's a very productive partnership. How did you guys start working together?
Well, Tool were recording at this studio in the Valley called Hook, and they were doing overdubs. Was it just overdubs and vocals? I can't remember, Tosh.
Guitar and the bass.
Bass.
Yeah.
And Tosh was the engineer there, or would it be engineer or house engineer?
Yeah.
And so then we liked the studio. It was a nice little studio. And so we booked a session there to do the recording. And Tosh was the house engineer. And we went in and he said, "So who's going to do all the recording?" And we said, "Well, you know how to run all this stuff, don't you?" He said, "That's how it works."
Yeah, that's how we started. Yeah, I met Buzz at the Tool session. He came,
yeah,
to check the studio.
That's how I found out about the studio, and that's where Tosh, you came to America to do recording school, right?
Yep.
Tell them about that.
Hmm. I went to recording school.
I guess you passed. So you guys met at a Tool recording session, and then Melvins that was getting ready to use the studio?
Yeah, we did a Melvins record there to start with, Hostile Ambient Takeover. Mm. And I've been we'd all made a lot of records prior to that. So I wasn't too concerned about, you know, about going in there with someone we didn't know. I mean, I figured, you know, we know enough about what we're doing. And if he knows how to run the studio, then he can push play and spool the tape. Then we'll take it from there.
And then as you started working together, you realized you had deeper connections. Is that kind of how it worked? Or what was it that kind of sparked that continued collaboration?
We have the same sense of humor. Mm. And like last year, we worked with on this record, the Tarantula Heart, we worked with Gary Chester. And he came in, and me and Tosh start talking to him. He'd never met Tosh. And so we go in the studio, and it's just me, Gary, and Toshi. And me and Tosh are like, fuck you, buddy. Fuck you. All this shit back and forth. And Gary later told me, I thought you guys were really pissed. I thought something was wrong. Like, now we're just fucking around. You know? That's how it always goes, though, you know. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So we have the same sense of humor. It's very dark. We get along really well along those lines. We like a lot of the same music. He told us that we were one of the first bands that came to record that didn't bring a bunch of other albums in and say, we want to sound like this. You know? So he thought that was cool. Didn't you?
Yeah, I am. Yeah. And then, those guys are super open-minded. You know, hey, how about this? Sure. How about this one? Why not? And so that was a really comfortable, you know, situation. So I get a lot of, you know, creative input, and then they didn't mind. So it's, yeah, I've been telling, it's like maybe Melvin's the reason I came in the U.S.
Yeah. Oh, they're the reason you stayed. You came for the school, but you stayed for the Melvins.
Yes.
Okay. And I imagine you guys probably have very similar work ethics as well.
Yeah.
Yeah. The buzz is very, some point of view, that, you know, really Japanese-like, you know, never late, be on time, and then finish exact time. That's it. The hostel didn't take over. We worked only 8 hours a day.
Yeah. And
21 days straight.
And yeah.
We are not tired at all, because on time, that's it.
How do you manage it? Because I would imagine when you're in the studio, it's, you can't always tell the exact time things will take. And then creativity kicks in, and, you know, a lot of people will stay late or follow that muse. But you guys are just almost like a punch clock, out at a certain time and disciplined like that.
I'd gotten sick of sessions ending at 2 a.m. for no reason. Mm-hmm. And I said, if we say we're going to get here at this time, we're going to leave at this time, we'll get it all done. You know, you get it done. If you're starting now, you know, let's say 11 and you end it at 8 or 7 or 8, that's it, you know, and have a break for lunch. You tend to get all your work done. If you're prepared and you go in there and you have I don't think after midnight for me, I'm very productive at all.
No, after 8 hours.
Yeah.
Yeah. You're just wasting time. Mostly.
Okay. Yeah.
I've had situations where we worked until 2 a.m. I get back there at noon and I don't like what we did.
Yeah. Yeah, that's usually.
It sounds like shit, you know. I'm just like, ugh, I don't want to do it, you know.
Yeah, and then the engineer point of view, after 8 hours, that's the time you're going to start making a mistake, erasing stuff by accident, you know. So it's a human, you know, working, no AI. So
yeah. And we weren't doing blow, so we weren't staying up late. So
you were staying up late making bad decisions.
No, we weren't.
So the way, as I understand, Tarantula Heart came together, and I'd love for you to tell the story, Buzz. It is very different, a very unique way of developing a record, certainly compared to the way things have been done in the past, yeah?
Oh, yeah. We've done a lot of records. I think, depending on what you count as an album, I'd say more than 30 albums. Mm-hmm. I don't know how many we've done with Tosh. Me and him have done a lot of things that aren't necessarily Melvin stuff. We worked really closely on this record we did called A Walk with Love and Death, where we did a normal album, and then the other one was a soundtrack album for a movie that didn't exist. Mm-hmm. And we just, me and him made, pretty much did that whole thing ourselves.
Yeah.
I think. But it was mostly me and him in the studio. For most of our albums that we've done with Tosh, I'm in the studio way more than anybody else is. You know, I'm there doing stuff way beyond any of the other members. And so me and him have a really good working relationship as far as like how well it works. And we've done a lot of different kinds of recordings. The soundtrack one was really fun to do. I really liked that record. And so on this one, we had just toured with Ministry. And on that tour, Roy, their drummer, would come out and play two songs with us every night. And so I was like, we got to do some recording. And he was like, okay. And then he brought a, what kind of synthesizer was that? It was an ARP synthesizer?
Yeah. Yeah. 2600.
Yeah.
Oh, an old one. Old analog one. Yeah.
I think it's an old one. Yeah, he has.
Yeah. He brought that down and he brought some drums down. We have in the studio that Tosh is in there. He's in the control room. And then we have a live room. And then there's also an isolation booth that we have a guitar and a bass in. So we set up Roy and Dale in the main room, kind of facing each other, I think, right?
Yeah, that's.
And then so they could see each other. Mm-hmm. And then through headphones, they had me and my guitar and Steven's bass. And then I had some rough ideas for riffs that I wanted to do. And we would start playing. And the drummers eventually will fall into what will happen if you just leave them to their own devices, let them go, is they'll fall into some patterns that are really cool. And what would we do? Six or seven?
Yeah, we did
like 20-minute jams.
Yeah, we didn't use like three takes. We did.
It was like seven or eight. I can't remember.
Yeah, we did a lot. But like
15, 20 minutes. And so we did that for 2 days. And then I took the rough mixes away and found sections that would work. Like the first one I did, I think was Allergic to Food, wasn't it? I think so. That was the first one. And when I wrote all these riffs to it that were not the riffs that we were jamming at all, but it worked. And then I put vocals on it and did a bunch of overdubs and stuff like that, and then played it for the band. I remember Roy was like, "What's this? I don't remember doing this." And one thing we did not do and is we did not sit there and chop a bunch of drum parts together, you know, like right. It was long sections of drums. And so that was really cool.
So the musicians got to hear themselves playing to music that they've really never played to.
No, that's it. You know, and you realize what you get out of that is the drummers are playing in a way they never would play on a riff like that because their accents are all wrong. Their accents are all different all over the place. And so if you played them now, this new thing, they would play it different. Just instinctively, they would play it different. And so we're getting a record like you can't get in a normal practice. Mm. You know, you can't. There's no way to do that. It's like when we go to play these songs live, we're going to have to learn them like they're cover songs.
Yeah.
Because we never rehearse these songs. And those versions live will be different because the drummers will play them different. Doesn't mean they're bad. It's just not going to be exactly the same. So when I did the first one, I was like, "Oh my God, this is great." I mean, didn't you think, Tosh? It came out pretty cool.
Yeah, it's super weird. Before the mix, it's like, is this okay? That's my in my head. It's like, you know, this is, you know, right things to do. Well, oh yeah, maybe, you know. And then started the mixing was totally different than I ever had before. You know, just the piles of the recording too. So. my main job of the mixing was started muting stuff and then clears out. Oh, this is great. You know, more I go, I was like, holy shit, this is great. You know, so wow. I never had that feeling before. It's just a usually know, okay, so this song is going to be good because chorus come here, you know, really structures. This is not planned at the beginning. You know, there's no structure. Where's the chorus? Where's verse? So it was challenging for sure, but it ended up really cool. So
it sounds like maybe it's somewhat related, an ancestor to what you did with Plan D, Toshi. Where you had the drummers playing and they didn't really hear what the outcome was.
That's funny. That when Buzz was explaining, it's like, I think I heard this one before. It's like, I thought it was the same thing when the Buzz was explaining. So I was thinking, it's totally different concept, but similar for sure.
Yeah, I wasn't thinking of that when we did it originally. I wasn't thinking. Oh, here's what we'll do. You know, I didn't think of that at all. It wasn't until later, after I listened to the rough mixes, I was like, oh, here's what we can do. Once I found a section, I can just write this whole new riff over it.
Yeah. It
has nothing to do with the original thing we did.
No.
And then have Steven come in and play some bass on it. And then later we had Gary Chester come in, and me and him did a bunch of guitar solos. I think there's more guitar solos in this record than we've ever done.
Yeah.
Isn't there?
Huh? Yeah, like you guys have like four solos each, and then
I each to, song.
That's the time I have to. It's like which one I have to erase. I have to, you know, view. That was my main job on the mixing. So it's like, then they start clearing up, and then whoa, this is cool song.
Oh yeah, it came out really good.
Yeah.
So starting this process, Buzz, you had, I guess. You hadn't done this process before. Had it been done elsewhere? Like who else?
Not that I know of.
Okay, so this is a new innovation. You just had to trust the process once you kind of started down that road.
Once I realized it would work, I was like, okay, now I can do this whole record like this. You know, so we never rehearsed once. There's no rehearsals for this record.
Right.
We don't know these songs at all. We never played them. You know, so. I love it. I love after this many records, I've come up with something. I don't know if I would do it again because now the drummers would be in on it. You know what I mean? They wouldn't be. It only works. The magic only happens because they don't know.
Yeah.
You know, and that's what made this whole thing cool. I'm very, very into what drummers do. I'm very, very excited about how it works and where the accents go. And I work really hard on a lot of the arrangements and I always have for drums. Like, don't do that there. This is where the vocals are going to go, blah, blah, blah. I love all that. I think it works really well. But to have it be like this, where I hear the accents are wrong. I was playing it for Adam Jones from Tool. He's like, the drummers would, once I told him, he goes, they would never play like that. You'd never get a drummer to play like that along with these riffs, you know?
Yeah, you got the drummers to play against their own nature.
Without them knowing at all. And it's subtle, and I just felt like I needed to tell people how this works because nobody's going to notice. They might think it's weird subtly, but they're not going to go, oh, I know what they did, you know? There's no way they would know that. And I'm not afraid to do a record like that. I'm not afraid at all. I mean, I think it's really cool, and I don't think I'm going to ruin anything or, you know, oh my God, it's going to be too weird. It's like, I don't give a shit. I'm capable of listening to, you know, a 20 minute opening song and always have been. It's like, people shouldn't look to us to do normal verse, chorus type songs. There's plenty of bands doing that. Don't expect us to. And that's almost a direct quote from what Zappa said that. There's plenty of bands that are willing to do normal music. Don't look to me to do it. It's like, right. Yeah. Completely, you know.
So in attempting to put together what Pain Equals Funny, the 20 minute track, was that at the end of the project once you kind of built up the rhythm and the confidence with the rest of the songs to then attack a 20 minute opus?
I don't remember. Was that at the end, Tosh? I can't remember.
Yeah, that's one of the last one, but the very first part is not from this project.
No, it's
from 3 years ago.
Something like that. It was right when I was doing my, because that same riff is part of a song on a similar riff is part of a song on a Gift of Sacrifice.
Oh, wow. Yeah. And then
I jammed it with the band, and then we changed it. I changed some of the, I added like a, I don't know what it would be called. It's after the main part of the song. I don't know what you'd call it.
Like a lying guitar?
A bridge, kind of. Into the next. And the next part, like the middle part of that whole song, that's one of my favorite things I've ever done. You know, I really like how that came out. I remember that was the last thing we recorded. The middle part of that, you know, with the straight.
Yeah.
Wrote all that stuff and then brought it in. Oh, here's the new song. Here's a new part of the song to this riff, and recorded it, recorded the vocals, had all that done. When did we do that? In about a day? You know, not even a day, no, you know?
Not even. Yeah.
Then we had that whole ending was this big thing that me and Gary, the drums were playing, and me and Gary just did solo after solo after solo after solo on that, and it came out amazing. Really, really like it. It goes from this beginning part that has all these harmony vocals into this weird middle part kind of full sounding into a total destruction nightmare, you know, all in one side of the album. And it really goes on a journey that I'm really excited about, you know.
No, there's, yeah, Stephen didn't even play the bass line on that part. He was playing a solo too. And then,
yeah. Oh, yeah, yeah.
That's Roy didn't play drums either. It's all, he was doing a synthesizer.
Yeah. Well, Roy recorded a whole bunch of synth stuff. And I forgot, we laid him down too, doing synthesizer stuff by himself. And then we would go and find pieces of that to add to all kinds of sections of all the songs, you know, a lot of them.
So you now have this music that was originally not constructed this way. I'm assuming there's going to be a Melvin's tour at some point where you're going to have to look at this material and say, okay, what are we going to play live? Have you thought through that and any particular tracks that you would or you wouldn't?
We could play all of it. The hardest one might be, I don't know what do you think? I don't know. I don't know what the hardest one would be. She's Got Weird Arms would probably be really hard. That was hard to do. And I worked pretty hard on that guitar part. Remember that was a pain in the ass, Tosh, that one? 900 guitar parts on it. You know, it's like, thank God.
Yeah. That we had harmonies.
Oh man, I just
really dissonant. Yeah,
that was tough. That was tough. You were with me figuring out what to do and all that.
Yeah,
because I after hearing Pain Equals Funny a couple times, like I could just imagine that being a centerpiece of a live set.
No, we could easily do that live, you know, some version of it. But we're going to approach it just like we would playing covers. You know, we haven't ever played it, so. Which, you know, I mean, I don't view live and recordings as the same at all, personally. I learned that early on. One of my favorite bands is The Who. And when I got up, when I was about 12, I got live at Leeds. I realized these songs are all different on here than they are on the records. And I was like, then it occurred to me, oh, you don't have to do them the same. So I've known that for most of my life. I've never let that worry me. And I would say, you know, arguably, Live at Leeds is the greatest live album ever, you know, to me. And their versions on there, I would say, rival, if not, or better than the recorded versions. Mm. So you know, that can happen too. I'm not afraid of that. Changing things live. We've always done that. We'll play songs live because I don't really listen to records after we're done with them. And then I'll go back to listen to it and go, oh, we're playing that totally wrong. Not even realize it. Oh well, you know.
Yeah. Or at a completely different speed.
Always.
Yeah.
But only that speed on the record, because that's how you did them that day. That doesn't, it's not written in stone. You know? Or we'll go, wow, we do that way faster, way slower. I don't know. It's not that precious to me.
Yeah. Was Tarantula Heart a bit of a product of kind of the pandemic? Like, you had time to be able to create and to record and to indulge a little bit. Was this part of that or somewhat similar?
No,
that was after.
Yeah. What was that? Go ahead.
That was after pandemic, right?
Yeah. After the pandemic. Because we did it with Roy. And yeah. we toured with Ministry right after the pandemic. That was the first thing we did.
That's right. That's right.
And then that was where I got the idea. Let's do some recording with Roy. It'd be great. So that's how it happened. So it's just within the last 2 years. During the pandemic, we did a Melvin's TV thing at the studio there. We did
Five-Legged Dog
Rising. What was that? Five-Legged Dog, Bad Mood Rising. You know, we did a ton of stuff during the pandemic. Five-Legged Dog was 36 songs, 2.5 hours of music, acoustic. That was the product of the pandemic.
and the Melvin's 83 too.
Melvin's, that's right. Yeah,
we started and then it happened. So we have to wait.
Yeah, we wait. Yep. Yeah. So we were not stopping at all during the pandemic at all. You know.
Mm-hmm. Did you build up a? Do you still have a backlog of recordings or songs?
After doing Five-Legged Dog, which was about 2.5 hours, and then Bad Mood Rising, and the Melvin's 1983, and the Melvin's TV thing. I don't really have anything else. I have lots of stuff that's not done, and I'm working on stuff right now.
You know? That's what you don't know. I have so many Melvin's unreleased stuff.
Oh, yeah. Massive amounts. We got to go through it all. You know, we're doing a session coming up in May. Me and Tosh and two of the guys from Napalm Death. And that's going to be really fun, because those guys are chomping at the bit to do something crazy with us. So that's going to be fun. I'm really looking forward to it.
Oh, wow. So Tosh, you mentioned there's a bunch of unreleased Melvin stuff. Is it just side cuts and bits and bobs, or are the real songs releasable material at some point?
Some of them is idea, and some of them just started, and then, like a bigger idea came, so kind of, you know, set it away. But there's some stuff I can just mix, you know, for sure. But again, it's just, I have to go through.
Yeah, we got to do that.
Yeah.
Okay. We got to do that. Tired of writing songs. Let's just use the stuff you have.
So, like, Buzz and Trevor, they're doing a tour here. In the coming months. So while they're busy with that, Tosh, you'll be kind of just working and tinkering on some of the recorded material and bringing it up to a condition that could potentially be reviewed and even released.
Yeah, but you know, the Buzz like to be in here, you know. So I'm sure he wants to go through with me. You know, so.
There's some stuff I'm sure if I heard it, I said, nah, I don't want to use that.
Yeah, that too, for sure.
That always happens. But what's weird is you'll listen to something that I didn't like from, like, you know, 10 years ago, and then I'll go, why didn't I like it? This is perfectly good.
You know, that's the first part of the painting called funny.
Yeah,
I made a mistake to make a rock mix CD, and the Buzz Storm is like, I remember this one, you know, we should finish it, you know. So I thought he asked me to make a CD of that particular session, but he didn't mean to. And then, this is great. So we have to use it. So that's the only one. Roy wasn't involved to making it, but it ended up, you know, he was playing a synthesizer. So
he does the whole intro.
Intro.
Yeah. I mean, we're really adventurous when it comes, like he said earlier, like, we're really adventurous when it comes to making recordings. I'm not worried about anything. I mean, you can't weird me out. There's no way, you know, to me, my ideal combination would be Captain Beefheart crossed with Judas Priest crossed with Throbbing Gristle. You know, that sounds amazing. And, I mean, how are you going to weird us out? It's just not possible. I don't know what we would do. Oh, wait, can't do that. Hold on. That sounds too weird. There's just no way. I mean, not if you listen to our records, listen to five of our albums, it should be clearly obvious that we're not, not afraid.
You guys left that guidepost long ago. Yeah, we're aware of that.
Yeah, yeah. I would like it when people would say, did you get a bunch of hassle from the record label on the, you know, when you're on Atlantic? I go, yeah, it was their idea to do a 9-minute drums only track to end the Houdini album. Yeah, you're right. That was them. That was all record company meddling. You know, it's like, what? You know, I don't know. I mean, Tosh is very open-minded. We've had decades of working together. It's worked really well. I don't see any reason to change it.
Mm-hmm. You know? So what have you learned from Toshi? And Toshi, I'm going to ask you the same question about Buzz here in a minute. But Buzz, what have you learned from Toshi?
Hey there, I gotta tell you about the Groove Washer. Not because I have to, but because I want to. The Groove Washer is the best record cleaner you can get. And if you have a vinyl collection, you need to keep it clean. Dirt and dust lead to groove wear, which affects the sound and value of your record collection. Use the Groove Washer to clean before each play, and your ears and future pocketbook will thank you. Ask for the Groove Washer by name at your local record store, or go direct to groovewasher.com and use promo code VinylGuide10 at checkout. Groove Washer is a great holiday gift. Why not send one to a friend? Groovewasher.com, discount code VinylGuide10. Do it now.
Hey there, all you record nerds. I want to tell you about BagsUnlimited.com. BagsUnlimited.com has a huge selection of vinyl record supplies. Whether you collect LPs, 7-inch singles, 78 shellacs, or anything in between, BagsUnlimited.com will sort you out. From polyline sleeves to cardboard record mailers to 7-inch storage boxes and archive quality record sleeves, protect your records of any size and shape at BagsUnlimited.com. Whether you have a small personal record collection or you're running a massive record shop, you can grab a small supply or even buy in bulk at BagsUnlimited.com. And they've got some really incredible, unique stuff. BagsUnlimited.com even has special size sleeves made especially to protect your box sets, storage boxes and sleeves for cassette tapes, protective supplies for reel-to-reel, and yes, even 8-tracks. Just go to BagsUnlimited.com, click on audio supplies, and prepare to be impressed by all the options they have. That's BagsUnlimited.com. So what have you learned from Toshi? And Toshi, I'm going to ask you the same question about Buzz here in a minute, but Buzz, what have you learned from Toshi?
That it's best to let the people that know how to record stuff, let them record. There's a reason you went to studios and you worked with engineers to begin with. I don't want to be an engineer. I don't want to know that much stuff about it, because I think then I will get stuck in a technical idea as opposed to a visual idea, or, you know, or how it sounds to me creatively. I don't want to know too much. You can overanalyze something to the point where you've beaten the life out of it. And I don't want to do that. And so it's better to work as a team for me than it is to try to dictate how I want something to sound. Let people do their jobs. And I've learned that if you have a good work ethic and a good set of ears, then you trust them. Like when I'm doing a vocal, I tell him, you tell me when it's right. I don't want to have to think about that, you know? And so then he'll tell me, okay, you got it. You got it. And so I don't mind having someone tell me something's right or wrong. I get frustrated, but it's always at myself. Always, you know, when I'm vocal, fuck, I can't do it. I can't do it. It's not because he's telling me it's not right. It's because I know he's right, you know?
Was that a hard lesson to learn? Like, was there a point in your career early on where you were trying to control everything and it just didn't work?
No. I just didn't know what I was doing at all. I didn't know what sounded good. And now my idea of what is good is massively expanded and has been. I mean, I would like to go back and record the records we did for Atlantic now I think we do a much better job on them. They sound overproduced to me now.
No? Is that something you'd seriously consider doing?
Oh, well, you never know, but I don't have any plans to do it. But when I listen to those records now, they sound a little stiff. They're well recorded. That mm-hmm. is true. But I've changed in what I think is good and bad. And I think working with somebody like Tosh, he knows exactly what he's doing. He's adventurous. He's fun. We get along really well. We don't need a lot of fancy gear to make really amazing sounding records. It's because it's, what's the saying? It's the Indian, not the arrow, you know? Mm-hmm. If we had a Tascam Porta 7 and that's what we were going to record on, I would trust him to make something that sounded good.
Let's do it.
Absolutely.
Okay, so that would be very interesting. A re-recording of those albums a la Taylor Swift.
I mean,
Buzz's version.
Like on our Five-Legged Dog, the definitive version of the song Night Goat is that version. Mm. Newest version. I like that way better. You know, that sounds way better to me.
So, Toshi, what have you learned recording and working with Buzz all these years?
Oh, man, I can't really learn from them because they are totally different than any other artist, you know. So most of the stuff what we do a lot of people are afraid of doing it, you know. So it's not, I mean, I'm not saying they don't have a guts or anything like that. It's just Buzz believes, you know, the stuff he brought up, somehow it works, you know, he knows it. And it's going to be a brand new idea, like this album. And then if I do that, no one wants to do that, you know, so I can't really do the same process to other band.
Yeah.
That doesn't work, you know, I mean, it's going to work, but they don't want to do it. So most stuff tracked the vocal, it's unusual. You know, a lot of people wants to do takes of the whole song and I comp it, you know, or section by section and then comp it, you know. But Buzz does line by line. Sometimes it's word by word and then keep moving. And then that, I don't think a lot of people has a patience to do that. So I think the Melvins is totally different, you know, different the work ethic and a different process. So I'm learning for next Melvins album, I guess. I can't really explain. Those guys are, yeah, different, you know. So very artistic, and then they don't afraid. Let my creativity out too. So it's not happen for the regular, you know, my daytime job, you know, recording, producing. It's not same. So I can't really say I'm learning, you know. This is more like excitement and then everything. It's just new things coming up, new thing. We never done the same thing again either, you know. So every album has a different thing. And hey, what do you think about this? Buzz bring up, sure, let's try it, you know. So every time is slightly different too, you know. So. Mm-hmm.
So
learning it is learning new thing, but I can't do the same thing with other bands.
Right.
You're learning all kinds of things you can never use again.
So, yeah, that's exactly. Yeah. So every session is brand new. So excitement, you know, just to bring excitement to me. So
with Tarantula Heart, it was recorded in such a unique circumstance. And Buzz even mentioned, you know, not sure if you could even do that again, or at least not with that element of surprise that you had for the first one. For upcoming projects, another method of recording? Do you think you'll go back to more of a traditional songwriting for the next one? How will you approach the next Melvins? Have you thought about that?
Oh, if anything, it'll be weirder. I don't, you know, I mean, I don't feel like we have anything to prove. And now it's just, what else can I do? What else will work? But the idea of going back and doing it the way that we used to a long time ago, it just sounds horrible to me. I would rather not do it. Mm-hmm. I'd rather not go back and record the same way I did with Stoner Witch. That sounds horrible. I don't like to work like that. I would not like to work like that now. I would not. Mm-hmm. That would bother me a great deal. I don't think that I need good people around me. Not necessarily the highest quality gear. You know what I mean? We can make something good with anything that's there. Like, you can put us in any studio and we can make it work. If me and my guys that I play with and Toshi, there's nothing we couldn't do. There's nothing we couldn't make work. Mm-hmm. Any equipment, with any guitars, with any amps, with any recording device, we could make it work, because I think these guys are the highest quality professionals as far as like their abilities. And Tosh is, to me, I would say the most underrated engineer in the whole entire world. That's what I think. He's crying now. See, I can't think of anybody that I would go, you know what? I've worked with Tosh for a long time, but there's this guy that I would really like to work with. I mean, unless Roy Thomas Baker's available, but he probably can't hear anything anymore. You know, who's your favorite producer, Tosh?
Yeah, Roy Thomas Baker for sure. Yeah, and then Mike Chapman.
Mike Chapman's amazing.
Yeah, there's quite a few. Yeah, Trevor Horn.
Yeah,
yeah.
But Roy Thomas Baker, I remember we were listening. Me and Tosh. Tosh had multi tracks of. Which Queen record? I can't remember. I think it was a News of the World, maybe.
I don't have a whole thing. Yeah, it's just a few songs. Yeah.
Yeah. He had multi-tracks of some songs. And he's just like, listen to this. It's five tracks of drums. That's it. And he goes, that's all they have. That's all they use. And he goes, it just makes me want to quit.
It was too good.
Good. Huh?
These days you have access to so much, so many tracks, so many sounds and timbres that you could bring into music. And you know, you go back to those records that we all love, you know, yeah, they were done on 8 tracks or 16 tracks or something like that. And a lot of times projects, in my mind anyway, part of what defines them, their characteristic, is the constraints that they had. Right now, there doesn't seem to be as many technical constraints. When recording, do you impose constraints on yourself? Does that play a role in the creativity?
Not me. I don't want any constraints. If I want to use 1,000 tracks and that's what I think will work, then I want to do it. Mm-hmm. You know, more is more to me. I don't imagine the Beatles would have said, we have 80 tracks available, but we're only going to use 4. Mm-hmm. Can't imagine they would do that.
But sometimes all those choices actually slow down the process or make it a little bit more tedious.
Probably to some degree, but Fleetwood Mac spent, what, a year on Tusk on the 24-track studio?
Yeah.
Like, you can get stuck in anything. I mean, what do you think, Tosh?
The process speed is just that people sometimes overthink, you know, and then I understand that, you know, they believe that there's something better, you know, come out, but at a certain point is good enough that we have to move on, and then they get that. I don't like the word you said, organic, but there has to be some kind of not super processed sound, you know. I don't like to repeat same thing as three times, four times, you know. They get into that. It has to be right, has to be right, has to be right, you know, so never end it. So if the songs are great, you know, there's a certain level, you know, I won't go polish too much. So,
Because the constraint could also be time. Shit, we got to get this thing out. Let's wrap it up by Thursday. And Buzz, you've spoken about not wanting to beat something to death. How do you keep yourselves from second guessing and maybe chewing the flavor out of something that is ready to go?
Well, I learned a long time ago that sometimes with drummers, especially recording them right when they just barely know it, is getting them at their most adventurous. Once they've overthought it, it kind of deflates the life out of it a little bit, especially for a recording. If you can get them right at that point of where they're about to explode, where they don't have it quite done, but they just played it right and you got that recording, you're getting a life out of that that's not going to happen 2 weeks from then.
It's a little bit of a high wire act at that point.
Yeah. You know? Yes. They're playing at the top of their abilities and they're trying to remember it. And they're, oh my God, we got to get it. And then they get it. And you're like, that, there's something about that element, that moment that I am very attracted to. You know, now we lose that when we practice it and maybe it'll change. But after so many albums, you know, I'm looking for anything that's going to give me some excitement. And I'm not use tracks. There's lots of stuff on our records where going way back where it's like, that's the first time the drummer ever played it on to the recording was the time we went on the record. Once, you know, we practiced it a little bit and then go. I'm not afraid of that at all. You know, at some point it's sick and you're making things to entertain yourself and you have to know when enough is enough and good enough is good enough.
So do you do the same approach with riffs? Like if you think of a riff or you write something, you're inspired, you make a quick recording of it and then try not to monkey too much with it until you get in the studio?
Well, no, I'll still write it. I'll go, I know this is good. I have to figure out how I'm going to make it work. But there's a saying that we say in the studio that is, I might be able to play it better, but it's not going to be better. You know, once you find that, if you can identify that, then you're really not destroying the true creative nature of a lot of stuff. Doesn't always work, but when it works, it's really cool. You know?
So let's talk about that, because the source of experimentation is you have to be willing to fail. And I'm sure there are some sessions that were failures or didn't come out the way you thought. What do you recall any experimental session that was you're more than happy to walk away from and not get anything out of?
How about you, Tosh? Think of anything? I think we've used everything.
We kind of knew, like, in the middle of recording, Buzz said, like, hey, Tosh, we don't need to use that. There's some of those, too, you know, what I have. So, one song we kept recording last few years. What was it? Cover song.
I remember.
Oh, Husker Du song.
Oh, we did that. We re-recorded that a bunch of times.
Yeah, because he wasn't happy.
It never came out the way I wanted it.
Yeah, so we recorded like three times?
Something like that. Three,
something like that.
So, and finally got it with the Helms of Lee.
Yeah.
Yeah. Finally, you know, but we've been trying that for, like 3 years. And it never sounded right. I would listen, I'd take, because what I'll do is, we'll make recordings and I'll want to hear a rough mix and then I'll take the rough mixes immediately. And rough mix to me means everything that you recorded, you're hearing. Doesn't matter the level. I want to hear everything that we recorded. And I go home with it and just listen to it a whole bunch of times. And if it doesn't do anything for me, then I move on. You know, just, but that doesn't happen too often. But after that, I knew this isn't right. I know we can do it better. Then the version that we got ended up being really good. That's a great version. But yeah, tried a lot on that one.
Yeah. So sometimes it happens, walk away from that, the project.
Okay.
Yeah, that particular song. But usually we salvage something out of it.
Yeah.
So let me ask you a few questions about, because we've got the vinyl version that's available. And obviously our listeners are vinyl nerds, and there's copies over at Ipecac. A lot of the limited ones have already gone. If people are looking for the rare purple one, there are some at Blixt. It's a bit of a secret. So jump over there, and there's a package with a shirt as well. When it comes to Hazelmeyer, Haze XXL, do you think we're going to see some issues of Tarantula Heart through AMRAP?
Well, hey there, record collectors. There's a new service available that specializes in record cleaning, restoring, sticker removal, and professional grading.
VMGVinyl.com.
VMG Vinyl can help you make the most of your collectible records. From professional cleaning of records and sleeves,
removing old price tags and store stickers,
dry cleaning and rejuvenation of old shrink wrap to make it look like new, even providing you a professional, play-tested, third-party grade with either removable grading or encasing in plastic, you have a wide range of choices at VMGVinyl.com.
Buying a highly collectible record and you want it checked out by an expert?
VMG Vinyl can do that too. Head over there now and see what VMGVinyl.com can do for you and your collection. That's VMGVinyl.com, the one-stop shop for professional third-party grading, cleaning, and record restoration. That's VMGVinyl.com.
When it comes to Hazelmeyer, Haze XXL, do you think we're going to see some issues of Tarantula Heart through AMRAP?
Maybe, but we're doing a remix, a massive remix of Pain Equals Funny that he's going to put out as a split with that band Boris.
Oh.
Yeah. So that's in the process of getting worked on right now.
Okay.
But it's like way different than the version that's on the album. So it's really like two different songs.
Okay. And that's something we'll see in the coming months.
Hopefully by the summer.
Oh, phenomenal.
You know, I want to have it on when I do the tour myself, the tour that I'm doing, you know.
Oh, with Trevor. You'll have some.
Yeah. I want to have it by then.
Oh, you know? Fantastic. All right. Well, that's coming up. Over the last few years, we've seen, I think, most of Melvin's vinyl reissues. I'm trying to think of any exceptions that haven't been reissued. Maybe Freak Puke. Is there anything that hasn't been reissued?
Colossus of Destiny on vinyl. We got to do that.
Colossus of Destiny. Okay.
Colossus of Destiny. And anything else that hasn't, we will redo. I mean, I think that there's, if you're open-minded, there's plenty of things you can do, especially if you're careful about it. All that stuff's highly collectible, especially the stuff we do with Hazelmeyer. Never goes to a store. Never. Mm-hmm. The only way you can get it is from mail order or buying it from us in person. And I'm very happy about that. It works well, and I'm okay with that. I understand how collecting works and how collectors think, and because I collect lots of stuff. So it's not something that me or Tom had any problem figuring out how to do.
Yeah.
Like, oh, just cut out the middleman. We don't give a shit if it goes to a store or anybody like that, but we're happy to sell it to them if they want to inquire and buy them, but they never do. So we'll just leave it between us and the fans. So be it. You know, if I was owned a record store, I'd buy all of them. You know, that stuff is really highly collectible and strange. I want that in my store. Oh, right. Yeah. There it is. That's all handmade. That we handmade all that in Austin, Texas. You know?
Yeah.
But I love that stuff. I love it. So, and Tosh puts up with, I'll go, yo, we have to have this mix for this right now. We need it today. We need it. How many times have I done that? Yeah. Huh?
A couple of days ago.
Days ago.
Right? How many times? Yeah.
I don't know. 100 at least.
Yeah. So that's that. But it, you know, I've been working with Dale, so something Dale complains. Like, well, Buzz asking me, he can say anything.
Yeah, exactly.
Kind of protected in a way. So. All right.
It wasn't my fault.
It's a minor one, yeah.
So, Buzz, tell me your understanding or your view of what happened with the recent vinyl reissue of A Senile Animal. There was a bit of a stuff up with the missing track on the record. What was your...
Things happen. It was just a screw up, but being the collector that I am, they were like, oh, well, we'll take all returns. I go, I'll take all the returns. I want them. Anybody stupid enough to send that fucking record back, I want it. Because I will resell it, because those are the ones that everybody's going to want.
You resell it at a premium.
No, fuck yeah. I go, are you kidding me? I'll take 10 of those. I'll take 50 of those. I'll put them right in my house and just hold on to them for a long time. Anybody that's dumb enough will happily give you back your money to anyone who's dumb enough to want to send those in. You know how many people did? Almost none.
Yeah.
Of course not. Why would you? You know? Those are the rarest ones of all. Right? But I mean, Jesus, it's like, do you not want something that's really cool and weird and fucked up? I do.
Well, you hand a lot of them over to Hazelmeyer, and he did a special package that is probably one of the most collectible Melvin sets out there.
That's it. That wasn't intentional, but you know, what do you do? Like, Ipecac was all freaked out. Oh my God, what are we going to do? I go, just don't worry. People aren't going to be dumb enough to give those back to you. Most people aren't. If they are, take them. It'll be fine. So, some people did, but I just like, really? If it was me as a collector, I'd have kept the fucked up one and bought the next one that came out. Both of them. I want the one that's messed up. I want it. I mean, you know how it works. Obviously, you collect records. Would you not buy a messed up Beatles album? Of course you would. You'd buy it.
Exactly. Those are the quirkiest ones. Yeah. I still have my the screwed up Senile Animal, and it's like, yeah, that's not going anywhere. I think most Melvin's fans, you know, they get the vibe of the band, right? So when that stuff up happened, most people were just, hey, that's okay. We'll wait till it's correct. I think the biggest pain in the ass was it was kind of somewhat in the middle of the period where you couldn't get vinyl pressed. It was like an 8-month wait or something like that. That was the only kind of thing, but everyone knew it wasn't the band.
No. I have no interest in intentionally doing something. We do enough collectible stuff as it is. I mean, I don't need another excuse to do it or some excuse. People go, well, it's just some way to rip people off. It's like, you get your money back. You know, how are we ripping you off if we're offering you a full refund? You know, like what's our angle? I'm sorry, but you know, it was not intentional. I mean, I could come up with something that was that smart, but you know, not usually. And it's just, you know, I mean, people like collecting stuff. They just do. That's just how it is.
One of my friends used to work at the record store, and then some dude came back with the Judas Priest album, and the inside is not same. And then it was a Neil Diamond inside, you know. And then he thought that was cool, so he kept it. And then he's a recording engineer, so he has to be in the same studio as Judas Priest. So Judas Priest signed over, Neil, you rock. He kept it, you know. So
that's hilarious.
Yeah.
If you sell it, that's going to be a lot of money.
You get lemons, you make lemonade out of it.
Yeah.
So we're starting to see a lot of bands making announcements, starting to manage the end of their touring life, not ending the recording so much, but touring. Are you starting to think, Buzz, about those sort of plans, like the end of Melvin's? What does that bookend kind of look like in your mind?
I don't have any plan to end. I still feel fine playing live. I'm fine with it. Bob Dylan's still playing live. Stones.
Yeah.
What is Mick Jagger, 80 years old? Bob Dylan's 80? They asked Bob Dylan, they go, well, why are you still touring after this long? And he goes, that was the deal I made. It's like, right. That's the deal he made. Like, I keep doing what I'm doing. Highway 61 Revisited. There it is. You know?
Okay.
I heard a professional skateboarder say the reason you retire is because no one cares or you don't care. That's it. So, you know, I think that's kind of it. I still want to do what I'm doing. I still feel good about it. I don't, I just turned 60 this year, just a few weeks ago, and I really feel much different physically than I did when I was in my 30s. So, so that changes, or I can't physically do it, then, or I don't want to do it. But I don't have a plan B. I never did. So, all I ever wanted to be a musician. I never wanted to be anything else. You know, I mean, if I had my druthers and I could just, you know, live in a fantasy world, then I'm a professional golfer. That's what I do. You know? That's not going to happen. But, you know.
Okay. All right. So we can expect, hopefully, to be seeing Melvin's recording, touring for the next several decades, hopefully. Till the wheels fall off.
We don't really need to make records at this point. I mean, we have enough stuff out there. We don't really need to, but I like making records and I like doing all that kind of stuff. So I still think we have something to say along those lines. And as long as that's the case, I'll continue doing it. I'm planning two more albums right now and I have enough, you know, I'm pretty much there with both of them as far as like, you know, halfway through my ideas about how it's going to work. I mean, records are easier to make now too. Everybody wants vinyl. Okay, vinyl's 35 minutes. You know, 40 minutes. I used to do 50 plus on a CD. So it's like people are, you want vinyl? Well, as you know, once you get about to that 19-minute point, it's pretty awful after that. You can't really jam too much more on there. So, 40 minutes is about it. That's an album. You know, so it's easier to do. You don't have to write as much stuff.
You got two more albums kind of in the hopper, at least kind of working their way through. Solo albums, Melvin's, one of each?
Melvin's, both Melvin's.
Yeah. Okay.
We're going to, when we come back with the, because Dale had a hideous operation on his neck. When we come back from that, and we were using Cody, who played with us before, we're going to be back to having two drummers. So our next album will have him and Dale both playing on it. So,
oh, okay.
That's the plan. Me, Steven, Dale, and Cody, and who knows what else.
Oh,
probably another Melvin's 1983 record as well. So working on that.
Oh, man. I'm so glad to hear things are continuing to move forward. So, guys.
Oh, yeah.
Toshi Buzz, thank you so much for joining us here. I want to make sure everyone knows about Tarantula Heart. April 20th, it's out. There's a couple tracks on streaming already. I think there's a video or two available, but you could pre-order the vinyl.
Yeah.
Get your copies at ipecac.com. Of course, you could also go to blixtmerchandise.com. I'll put the link in this episode page to where you can get some of the collectible neon violet vinyl along with a Melvin shirt. Make sure you check out Buzz on tour with Trevor Dunn. They're going to be touring across the U.S. this summer and into the fall. And hopefully we'll see Melvin's be playing some shows 2024. Do we think we'll see that, Buzz?
We'll see.
Okay.
You know, I'm doing about 70 plus shows with Trevor. And we take it from there.
Okay.
We got stuff planned. I just can't tell you at the moment.
excellent. Okay. Well, you know, keep your eyes wide open. Toshi also has quite a bit of material as well. ToshiKasai.bandcamp.com. Of course, you can find Plan D over at JoyfulNoiseRecordings.com. All these links will be in the episode page. And gentlemen, thank you again so much for making the time.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All right. See you later. Take it easy. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Man, God, those guys are funny together. You got to check out the extended interview. They talk about all the pranks they pull in the studio and all sorts of stuff there. More up at patreon.com/vinylguide. And you get to support the show. That's always fun. And again, don't forget to get a copy, Tarantula Heart. You could load up a couple of tracks on streaming right now and set yourself up to get the whole album on April 20th when it's released. And you can also pre-order vinyl at ipecac.com or blixtmerchandise.com. And that's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Thank you so much for tuning in.
And I appreciate each and every one of you for listening, and especially those of you who are sharing these episodes on social media, putting them on Facebook, tweeting them out on X or whatever it's called, putting them in the Reddit forums or the Facebook groups. That is always hugely appreciated. And of course, those of you who are leaving positive reviews on Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Again, huge thanks to each and every one of you. And we'll be back shortly with a brand new episode. So until we talk next time, get out there and buy some records, people. Cheers.
That's it for this episode of The Vinyl Guide. Follow The Vinyl Guide in Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or whatever podcast app you use and enjoy the full back catalog of episodes of The Vinyl Guide podcast. Thanks again for listening.